Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. This morning, in the first hour of the show, we'll be talking with Elizabeth Cook Lynn. She is a Native American writer, poet, novelist, scholar, certainly well known for writing about Native American experience in all of her writing, both in fiction and in journalism, and as a scholar. Particularly known for writing about, thinking about the kind of tensions that exist between modern Native American culture and the rest of American society. She's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. She's spending a couple of days. Her visit is sponsored by the folks at the Native American House, and we're pleased to have her here with us. She'll be giving a talk at 4:30 this afternoon at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. The title is Indigeneity as a Category of Critical Analysis. So if you're interested, you can certainly stop by. She's authored a number of books, and I wanted to particularly mention one, and that is New Indians, Old Wars, and it is published by the University of Illinois Press. As we talk, of course, questions are certainly welcome. Let me tell you a little bit more about her. She's a member of the Crow Creek Sioux tribe. She was born in Fort Thompson, South Dakota, raised on the reservation. She is Professor Emerita of English and Native American Studies at Eastern Washington University in Cheney, Washington. She's taught high school in New Mexico and South Dakota, has been visiting professor at the University of California, Davis, and spent most of her academic career there at Eastern Washington University beginning in 1971. Since she retired, she has served as a writer-in-residence at universities around the country and certainly does a lot of speaking, and we're really pleased that she could be here and spend some time with us. Questions are welcome from people who are listening. The number, as always, 333-9455. And we do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are welcome. We just ask people to try and be brief as they can, just so that we can keep moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But certainly, anybody listening is welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
The part, as I understand it, part of what New Indians, Old Wars is about, it is about how it is in academic settings you address the experience of Native Americans and their place in American history. Assuming that that's right, or at least that's a part, maybe I could ask just as a general question about that and how well you feel as history is taught in schools in the United States, it's dealt with generally with the experience of Native Americans, and maybe specifically how Native Americans occupy an important part in the civil rights history of the United States, but that's not something that seems to be acknowledged or talked about very much.
Yeah, well, I guess one of the reasons for my writing about a lot of these matters is that I really do believe that the past 500 years of colonization of the indigenous people in this country has not really been fairly addressed in history. Mm-hmm. And the reason that America doesn't do that is because America really does not want to face its predatory past, and doesn't have to. Now, in particular, America's the only elephant in the jungle these days, and so it doesn't have to. Mm-hmm. And so I think that history has not dealt with not only American Indians unfairly, I mean, it has dealt with them unfairly, but it's dealt with itself unfairly. I think, you see, that if you look at the experience of the past 500 years of American colonization, growth, and so on, and if you analyze Indian lives and Indian survival and all of that, we find that anti-Indianism is simply embedded in American culture. And maybe there was no way to prevent that. I don't know. But from my point of view, as a teacher and as a writer and so on, I think it is absolutely necessary for the Indian Wars to give standing, to be given standing. The Indian experience is to be given standing in this ever-growing narrative about America and its future. Mm-hmm. So it's not just Indians, you know, who become the victims of this false business about history. It's all of us that become the victims of it.
You use a term that I'm sure in some people's minds is going to be very contentious. Maybe not in Indian minds it won't be contentious, but in the minds of a lot of other people, and that is colonization. They're talking about Indian people as a colonized people. How is that the case?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of America doesn't understand that. Yeah. But the truth is that American Indian populations and American Indian nations are the most colonized people in any democracy. And it began, you know, a very long time ago. But it certainly began in 1934 and so on with the Indian Reorganization Act. Not only began there, it grew out of that, a lot of it. We have lands. I come from a reservation that's 300,000-400,000 acres. Our land is held in trust by the federal government. We have no banks at all on any Indian reservation in South Dakota. There is no economy. It comes out of Washington, D.C., the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Department of Interior. And there's just a massive, massive kind of legislation that has gone on for years and years and years. And the U.S. Congress claims plenary power over Indians, over American Indians. And that prevents a lot of what may be called the American dream and its possibilities for American Indians.
See, now, I guess it was my understanding, and as shallow as it is, that the intent of this legislation, now going back many decades, was indeed to establish Indian sovereignty.
Well, that's what they tell you. That's the fraudulent narrative mm-hmm. that comes out of that. I don't know what the answer to that is, but for America, it's always been power and politics and capitalism. And Indians have really fought against that for a very long time. But yes, that's the lip service that's given, and Indians buy it too. I mean, I have relatives who are on the tribal political scene, and they have bought it too. That this is what will make us a sovereign again, as we were once. I happen to take the view that all of that is a fraud. Look, I'm very lucky to have publishers like the University of Illinois Press, who really are helpful in my expression of what I think about America as a fraud. American democracy is a fraud on every Indian reservation in the country. And I say it, I write it, and I give you evidence for it. Just because you have an election of an executive that turns out to be called the tribal council doesn't mean you have a democracy that's going on. Court systems on Indian reservations are a shambles. We have no judiciary. We have no legislative function as nations. What kind of democracy is that?
Well, what would the alternative have been? I suppose one alternative would have been assimilation for Indian people to...
No, the alternative would have been, I think, for us to have been allowed our nationhood back in the 1800s, the alternative would have been for America not to steal our land. The America that I know has been predatory in every sense of the word toward American Indians. So we are the poorest people in the country. I come from a place called the Crow Creek Indian Reservation. It is in Buffalo County. The latest census tells us that Buffalo County is the poorest place in the nation. The home of the Crow Creek Sioux. We are Santees and Yanktons. And there is no, you know, if you're going to depend on casinos to, you know, bail you out of this, good luck. I mean, it isn't going to happen on Indian reservations like the one that I come from. Mm-hmm. And there are 300 or 400 Indian reservations in this country that are, you know, basically in the same boat. So the alternative would have been for us to have claimed our nationhoods, our sovereignties from the very beginning. When you look at the legislation that has affected my tribe, after the Indian Wars in 1868, we signed a treaty that was called the Fort Laramie Treaty. All sorts of tribes in the Midwest did. That lasted barely a decade. So our treaty land was invaded by the U.S. Army and Custer, and he was defeated and killed, and all of his men were. The Black Hills Act was passed by Congress in 1877, a year after that, and it stole 7.7 million acres of treaty-protected lands from the Sioux Nation. Now, every a tribe in the country can tell you a story like this. That didn't have to happen. The theft of 7.7 million acres of land did not have to happen. But that was Congress in its anger and fit of pique could do that. Indians had no access to the courts in those days. Indian nations did not. Indian people did not. And so the destruction of the economic system that we knew went on. And that's when the colonization of Indians really got into full swing. Sooner rather than later, the Allotment Act was passed. That was passed in 1889, just before South Dakota became a state and North Dakota became a state and Montana became a state and Wyoming and so on and so on. And the Allotment Act stole another two-thirds of the treaty-protected land that we had, that our ancestors had fought and died for. So those kinds of things, you see, really didn't have to happen. But, you know, if you look at what's going on in the world, that's what's happening in Iraq right now. And the last part of my book, the last part of my book does tell you that, that Iraq is being invaded. It's opened to capitalistic predators. And it's in my view, worrisome. It should worry every American in the country. So you can see why my work is controversial. And look, I've got some wonderful editors at the University of Illinois Press who talk to me as though all of this matters. And I really appreciate them a lot.
Maybe I should just very quickly introduce again our guest, Elizabeth Cook Lynn. She is a member of the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe. She's writer, poet. She's professor emerita of Native American Studies at Eastern Washington University. She now makes her home in South Dakota, Rapid City. She's authored a number of books, a couple of them published by the University of Illinois Press. One I, again, just want to mention is New Indians, Old Wars. She's here visiting the campus, spending a couple of days, and questions here are welcome, sir, if you want to be involved in the conversation. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I guess, you know, one of the things that I have been struck by over the years in talking with people about these kinds of matters is this, the perception that there are an awful lot of Americans who don't even understand that there still are American Indians. I've heard this again and again. For example, from people who Native American people who work in schools, that they somehow think that they have little kids, and they somehow think that the children think that. Well, first of all, Indians are people who they wear feathers and they live in teepees and they ride horses, and the very idea that there could be, you know, now American Indians, and they, you know, kind of like look like we do, and they drive pickup trucks, and you know, they work in construction, or you know, they do whatever. It seems like a very strange idea. You know, the idea that there actually is a current contemporary Native American population in America. I think a lot of people don't. It's almost as if they don't know that.
Oh, well, I certainly agree. There are many kinds of genocide, you know, that occur. And this historical disappearance of Indians is a kind of political genocide that has happened. But I think you're right, and Illinois is a part of that. And it's very interesting to me that Illinois has continued with its thinking, which is just exactly what you've described. And the whole mascot issue here exemplifies that. You know that the whole mascot thing was invented by America and universities all over the place, especially in the West, in the 1900s and in 1920. That was before the Indian Reorganization Act that we just spoke of, 1934, which was a kind of a rejuvenation of sorts. But the final defeat of the Indian was thought to have occurred then, or it was at hand, certainly, vanishing, you know, the closing of the frontier, all of that sort of thing was thought to be at hand. The savage was eliminated. And so the mascot then, as a kind of nostalgic way to reinvent itself for America, happened. We can play Indian at halftime. Well, Indians are gone, so we can play Indian. Illiniwek, I think, came about 1926, if I'm not mistaken. I shouldn't talk as though I know something about Illiniwek, because I really don't. But it's kind of a symbol. There's a kind of an imperialistic nostalgia for the vanishing Indian that's expressed in that symbol. It's a creative power on the part of America to see itself in a certain kind of way. But let's not fool ourselves. It's always been about domination. It's always been about domination, and mm-hmm. it still is. Colonial powers dominate, and they refuse to give up that kind of domination.
There have been times when the American government and people thought they had the best interest of Indian people at heart when they did things like try to get them to settle down and be farmers and take Indian kids away from their families and put them in Indian schools and tell them cut their hair and make them dress in Western European dress and told them they couldn't speak their languages and told them they couldn't speak their religion. And I know Indian people see that as an effort to extinguish Indian culture.
Mm-hmm.
Americans, I'm sure, thought that they were just trying to do something good for
Indian
people.
Give them more credit than they deserve. If you read the congressional files, as some of us have, you understand that there's always been a political agenda for America concerning American Indians. And that political agenda has been to get the land, get the resources. And if you think the days of that is over with, you're quite mistaken. State power has confiscated lands all over the place. The Yankton Sioux Indians just lost 180,000 acres to the state of South Dakota. In the year 2002 or something like that. So if you think the days of stealing Indian land is over with. And so I think America is just kidding itself. I think Americans really are in denial. I guess that's a psychological term, but I don't think it's a political term. But I think Americans are just in denial about their own history. You know, everybody should start out reading A Century of Dishonor, which is written by Helen Hunt Jackson. And she wrote it and published it, I think, in very early on, like 1820 or 1840 or something like that. A Century of Dishonor. And she pinpoints what it is that America was doing in the 19th century. And if you read it, you realize that America is still doing it, you know, in 2001. Mm. And that's kind of my message as a writer. And I want to say again how important it is for a university press like the University of Illinois to take these kinds of out of the mainstream ideas and make them public, get them into the schools, and so on. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of university presses that are not that brave, courageous, insightful. I know, because I've had a lot of rejection for my writing.
Well, just again, though, I wonder whether to what extent we truly are talking about denial, and that is that people know this history and yet they are ignoring it, or whether it is, much of it is actually that people don't know the history. Mm. Now, that I suppose that's again a form of denial, but it's a little bit different.
Yes, I don't know how to answer that question because for me, you see, there are not two sides to this story. There never has been two sides to this story. You cannot invade a people's land, steal it, kill them, make beggars of them, and then say you are innocent. America cannot do that. For me, that's the way it is. There are not two sides to this story. I realize that I'm a very narrow-minded person, and I'm not a classically trained historian. I'm not even a scholar, really, when you think about it. I think I've always wanted to be an investigative journalist or something, because I write all of these snotty little essays, you know, everywhere. But I've never bought the business that America really didn't know what it was doing and that Americans are somehow duped into thinking of themselves as innocent in this history. I don't believe it for a minute.
Hmm. We're at a midpoint here. We will talk some more with our guest Elizabeth Cooklin in just a moment and take a couple of calls. But first, we need to do this. This is a test of the emergency alert system. You're listening to Focus 580 here on AM 580 WILL Urbana. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. Let me again just give you a quick introduction to our guest, Elizabeth Cooklin. She's a poet, writer, has written journalism and fiction both. She is a member of the Crow Creek Sioux tribe. She grew up in South Dakota. She is professor emerita of English and Native American Studies at Eastern Washington University in Cheney, Washington, and now is living in South Dakota. She has taught high school in both New Mexico and South Dakota. She's been visiting professor at UC Davis and spent most of her academic career at Eastern Washington, beginning in 1971. She's the author of a number of books, and again, there's one I want to mention. This book is published by the University of Illinois Press. It's titled New Indians, Old Wars. She is here visiting the campus, spending a couple of days, and will give a talk this afternoon. It's sponsored by the Native American House, and she'll be speaking at the Levis Faculty Center at 4:30 this afternoon, and that's at 919 in West Illinois on the U of I campus. Anyone, I'm sure, who would be interested in hearing more from her should feel welcome. And questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have several callers here. We'll start with someone listening in Gibson City, line number one.
Yes, hello. So glad to listen to you. And my mother was born on the Red Lake Indian Reservation in northern Minnesota. And she was the only one of her relatives that married and moved off the reservation. And it wasn't until I got into school and realized that I was different by having Native American blood in me. But anyway, that's kind of my background. And, of course, I younger and busy raising a family. It's just now that I'm beginning to really dig into my roots, my mother's roots and that. And I really hope to start reading more books, and I'm glad I heard about you. There's so many things I want to talk about and ask about and say about, but there's just a couple of things. One of the things was interesting. We moved to Pennsylvania, and gal, my husband worked with, went to Minneapolis to visit. This has been many years ago. And she came back and she said, I didn't know there were so many Hispanics or Mexican people in Minneapolis. She said, I didn't think they moved that far north. And my husband, educator, no, these are Native Americans, you know. And it just really threw us that, oh, my goodness, you know, here we're, this woman didn't even know that there were Native Americans living in Minnesota. So that was kind of an eye-opener for me. And the other thing is I've been...
What's the question? What's the question?
Well, one of the questions I wanted to know is, I know there's a difference between reservations, and I know that Red Lake is a closed reservation and there's open reservations. That's the other thing. And the other thing is I wonder the difference in the two cultures when the white Anglos came over, that the Native people thought it was really hilarious that they, you know, that they wanted to buy land because they shared the land, and what difference that caused. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, thank you for your discussion. You know that there were 1,000 different cultures in this country, 1,000 different Indian nations. Now there are something like 300 plus or 400. The Dakota Lakota culture is very different from the Chippewa Ojibwe culture. It's very different from Hopi. It's very different from Navajo. Languages are different. I speak a language that a few thousand people speak. It's not understood by other native peoples who come from other tribes. So when we talk about culture, we have to understand that it's not just Indian culture against white culture, vis-a-vis white culture. I don't know where I'm going with that, but in response to the business about land, these Indian nations always knew what land they possessed, and they fought for it, died for it, had wars over it, just like every other nation does. The Sioux Nation fought wars with the Crow in Montana over land. They formed alliances. One of the most important military alliances was Lakota, Arapaho, Cheyenne. The most important military alliance that defeated Custer. That's a very different alliance from the alliances that you formed, that were formed in California or Arizona or on the East Coast or somewhere else. So there is a huge, huge history here in this country that is an indigenous history. That's one of the focuses of, or foci, I guess you would say, of Native American studies. To try to understand this, but I really understand your point of view that America doesn't get it. The average American white person doesn't get it. I don't know what to do about that. America doesn't know anything about China either. You know, America, the average American doesn't know anything about Canada. So I think that, you know, from the point of view of a professor, I think we have a lot of work to do to educate ourselves as people, not just you and your family and seeking your roots. There are lots and lots of Indians in this country who know their roots. They know their languages. They know their lands. There are certain lands in the Midwest that are claimed by the Lakota, Dakota people and have been claimed since thousands of years ago. Our mythologies, our star knowledge, our religions tell us where we have always lived. That's why we have sacred sites. That's why we have sacred places. The Black Hills is a sacred place to the Sioux. Not just because we, you know, fought with America over it, but because we have been there for thousands of years, and our mythology tells us that. The star stories that we tell us where we came from, what geography we occupied, you see. So there's a lot of that kind of history that's being lost every day, that isn't being given any kind of agency in history courses or political science courses. So there's a great deal of loss for America if it continues to kind of ignore Indians.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with someone else. Next is someone in Urbana. This is line number two.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello. How are you?
Yes, I'm fine. I'm very sympathetic and empathetic toward the Indian people and your story. And I think it's highway robberies, what the government is doing. They gave all this land to the Indians because they thought it wasn't worth anything, and now they're finding it's full of oil and all kinds of other things, and they're taking it all back.
Well, I've got to tell you that the United States government did not give any lands to Indians. Indians possessed it before the United States ever existed.
Okay, but they sent them out west. They sent the Indians west to get rid of them.
Well, Indians have always been in the West.
Well, anyway, I just want to say that I think this is like Cain and Abel. And Cain wanted what Abel had, so Cain killed Abel to get what he had.
Uh-huh.
And this is what's going on with the Indians. This is what's going on in Iraq. The United States wants the oil, so they're killing all the Iraqis to get the oil. They killed all the Indians to get the land away from them. So I do think it's terrible the way that you are treated, and I just want to say that.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the call.
Okay.
I again want to thank the caller, too. Let's go on. We'll talk with somebody else. Champagne is next. This is line number three.
Yeah,
hello.
I just have a few comments.
Yeah.
First, I haven't disagreed with anything that you've said, and, you know, I'm white, if you want to put it that way. I think part of it, too, is this whole thing of the superiority thing.
Uh-huh.
And that's the same thing that's going on today, is that, you know, like you said, I thought that was a wonderful expression, you know, the only elephant in the forest.
In the jungle, I think I said.
I'm sorry, okay.
Yeah.
But the one that you really didn't touch on, which is really a terrible thing, is that, what is it, through Indian affairs in terms of the money, is no idea, you know, what's happened to it, and no accountability. And supposedly that was supposed to be an investigation. And then what was the other one in terms of this, you know, this congressman in terms of the, you know, they dealt with some of the Indians in terms of the casinos and took their money.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What was his name? The lobbyist,
yeah.
and his dealings in Washington, D.C. with all of the congressmen.
But
Jack something.
Oh, Abramoff.
Abramoff. Jack Abramoff.
But, I mean, by far the worst is this, all this money, and I think it was, what, mineral rights, all that kind of thing, that they don't have a clue.
Well, I know. It's a huge, big cover-up, you know, like it always has been. I think, well, I don't know. Did you have a question about that, or did you just want to comment about it?
I'll let you comment, but you're doing a great job.
Okay. Yeah, well, Louise Cobell is doing a great job, too. She's got a case against the U.S. government and the bureaus and the bureaucracies, and I'm hoping to see how that goes. It's really not about money, but I suppose it's about systems of some, you know, predatory systems that are based in capitalism, basically. I don't want to sound like Karl Marx, but I think that it's I agree with you that, you know, it's just quite awful. And when you get caught up in all of these bureaucracies, as we are, I just don't know what to say about it. But as a professor, I do believe that education is the answer. You know, I keep saying that. And it's one of the major arguments that I make in my book about how necessary it is for us as Americans to do something beyond just produce biologists and engineers and technocrats. We have to begin to understand ourselves as a nation of people with values and morals and all of that sort of thing.
Well, are you thinking mostly about what happens at college and university, or is this something that you'd like to see taught at the other levels, at secondary and primary levels of school?
Well, I think that third world populations all over the globe need to be given agency in education. I just attended a meeting of indigenous nations in Hawaii. The Maoris were there from Australia. The Indians were there from Canada. People were there from New Zealand. Maybe the Maoris are in New Zealand, yes. And so there were indigenous nations that were there saying, you know, we have the same issues. Oh, no African nations were there, but they should have been. But there are indigenous people all over the world who are looking for ways to survive capitalism, democracy, Christianity, whatever else, you see. So I think we have to look up from our little narrow points of view, and I'm as narrow-minded as anybody. But we have to look up from our little places and see ourselves in some kind of world context. And so that happens everywhere. It happens, you know, in kindergarten, on reservation schools. It happens in kindergarten here in Champaign. It happens in the eighth grade, you know, in Boston. I think that we do have to give agency to a population that has been thought unimportant in this world.
Well, maybe I better ask you what you mean by that, other than a voice, perhaps, but just someone having a voice, that doesn't necessarily mean that they have power or control over their own destiny.
Yep. And it's about power, isn't it? It's all about power. As a matter of fact, going back to Chief Illini, it's about power. My point about that is that any body of knowledge has to be organized so that it has power. So just saying that there is indigenous knowledge out there, Indians know this, and they another population knows whatever, just saying that does not give knowledge power. That's one of the reasons that I'm in Indian studies. It's one of the reasons I'm not in anthropology or an English department or someplace else. That's not a slap at all of my wonderful...
Nothing against the anthropologists or the English
professors. All of my colleagues who are in history departments and anthropology and English departments. But it's one of the reasons that I'm in Indian studies is because I think that indigenous knowledge exists. Our languages exist. Our histories exist. And in order for us to have power, we have to develop systems, educational systems, that protect us, defend us, and that help us to transcend our present condition.
We have a couple of minutes left. We have two callers. We'll see if we can get them in. Next, Belgium, line four. Hello.
Yes. I'm afraid the topic that I was going to bring up is much more in-depth than that. But you did mention Chief Illini and all, and I find him a very obnoxious symbol. But at the same time, I have to point out that when Pierre Marquette came down the Illinois River, the Illini were the reason why he named this state. But when further explorers came down, the Illini no longer existed because other other groups had killed them all off. Now, we as Americans are not the only people who are aggressive to our neighbors. And thank you very much.
All right.
Well, was there a question involved in that is what I want to know about it. I certainly agree that, you know, war is a human condition.
All right. Well, we'll try to get one more here. We'll go to Charleston, line one. Hello.
Yes. I'll ask this question. What is your solution? And I want to add that as a Marxist, I think I understand what the solution is.
Oh, yeah? But what is it? Tell me.
It is social revolution.
Ah.
It has to be done militarily. If you're going to overthrow those in power, then you must supersede that power, and they go out of existence, just like it has been from ancient times.
Uh-huh.
And unless we learn that lesson, then we're doomed to suffer through the final stages of capitalist and bourgeois power, which is they are all-powerful, as you said over and over again.
Yeah,
today.
Yeah.
And they have all the power. They are not going to share that. And the only way you supersede a hegemonic power is with military force.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm kind of like those people who... Are we about finished?
We have about 3-4 minutes.
Okay. Well, I don't know what to say about war. I have a grandson who is in the Marines. I'm worried to death every day about him. I had husbands who were fought in this country. My father was in the infantry before he was even a citizen. He became a citizen in 1924. He fought in World War One or Two or whatever. And so I don't know what to say about war, but what I do want to say, I want to end up by saying, probably, is that there is an historical lie about America that continues to plague us. And now, America has become the first colonial settler country to achieve great murderous power. And I think that we all ought to worry about that. Colonialism is a crime, and it should be taught that it's a crime. Instead, we teach it as a wonderful American beginning. So I think that there is something to say for education.
Well, just going to the more pragmatic issue about Indian people and what conditions are, you know, the way that they're living today, and I'm sure that a lot of people and a lot of Indians ask the same question, and that is, well, what do we do?
Yeah.
What's to be done when you are extremely disadvantaged and when you've been denied to be able to benefit from from your own resources, the resources of the land on which you live, and when there's clearly institutional racism in the United States, so Indian people have a lot of problems.
Yeah.
What can be done?
Well, actually, we got to pull ourselves together. First of all, we have to stop the kind of destructive behavior that we engage in as a people, as a tribe. But the other thing is, David Wilkins, who teaches at the University of Minnesota, is a Lumbee Indian from South Carolina or North Carolina or wherever. And he says that one of the first steps is for U.S. Congress to deny its claimed plenary power over us. It's just a claimed power. It has nothing to do with the Constitution. It's not a constitutional power. So the U.S. Congress takes a lot of blame for what has happened to us.
And then would you see the idea of a true Indian sovereignty? Or would that still be the goal?
Of course. Of course. Indian nationalism is a real thing. We are not. The Lakotas are not like the Hopis. And our legislation and our land use and our economics and all of that stuff should not be an amalgamation or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody needs a casino, you know. But that's the U.S. version of us. We're all the same. I never call myself a Native American. I'm a Dakota, Isanti. And that's different from a lot of other things that you can say you are. And I come from a nation of people. There are 7 council fires of the Sioux Nation. They've always existed for 1,000 years. What right does America have to tell me that doesn't exist anymore?
And then what? I'm still trying to understand or get some idea of then what, for example, just if we talk about the Sioux people, the Lakota people, what then would be their relationship with the United States? It would be like another country?
Well, we do have dual citizenship. Mm-hmm. We have citizenship as U.S. citizens, and that's since 1924. We've never been asked to give up the citizenship in the Sioux Nation, and we never have. And so, yes, we can exist as nations within a nation. That threatens nobody. And Vine Deloria is the one who came up with that concept and verbalized it. We are domestic nations within a nation. There are other examples of that in France and places. And there's no reason why America can't help us to achieve that.
Mm.
That's what the Lakota people want. We want to be a nation within a nation. We possess land, lots of thousands of acres of land. We possess water. We possess resources. And we should be allowed, as a people, with a language and religion and geography, we should be allowed to exist. Not only allowed to exist, but we should be part of America's achievement as a democracy.
Yeah. And just again, as we've talked about, we talk about that being the case now, but that, you know, the nation within a nation. But it sounds as if what you're saying is that we may say that, but in fact, it's really not that way.
Yeah, I think that we give lip service to it, and the Congress doesn't know anything about us much, and I think it's a big struggle. And so I think that's the contemporary struggle for American Indians, is to continue to possess that kind of sovereignty and that kind of nation within a nation status. It's the struggle for the 21st century, as a matter of fact.
Well, there we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. If you're interested in reading some of the work by our guest, Elizabeth Cook Lynn, you can look for her book, New Indians, Old Wars. It's published by the University of Illinois Press. She is visiting here on the campus. We'll give a talk. This is sponsored by the folks at Native American House. She'll talk this afternoon at 4:30 on the U of I campus at the Levis Faculty Center. She is a professor emerita of English and Native American Studies at Eastern Washington University and now makes her home in South Dakota. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here. Thank you for the invitation.
Just to mention that coming up a little later today on the Afternoon Magazine, 2 years after Katrina, New Orleans struggles, but the Crescent City's problems seem largely off the nation's stove, let alone the front burner. On the Afternoon Magazine today, Celeste Quinn, the host, talks with a man who calls New Orleans home, Billy Southern. Southern, he's author of the book Down in New Orleans, Reflections on a Drowned City. I'll be talking following the 1 o'clock news. Celeste Quinn is the host. The Afternoon Magazine gets underway at noon. The broadcast today is made possible in part by a grant from Trophy Time and Champagne, with plaques and promotional products to recognize all occasions from athletic endeavors to musical moments to business achievements. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. Additional information on the web, trophytime.com. We will break for news and update on the market, so please stay tuned.
Commodity markets, where we begin today with a look at the outside markets, where we see that crude oil contracts are making all-time contract highs. December crude oil, a high today of $97, the first time that crude oil has traded that high. Currently trading at $96.93, up $2.95 on the day. That in turn is helping push commodity prices higher today. And in the soybean pit, we're making new contract highs there as well. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. In Kansas City, December wheat at $8.27, up 14 and three quarters.